It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a Milwaukee production of a play that tackles race and class issues framed in the aftermath of the verdict in the Rodney King trial back in 1992.
But first, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us to talk about Governor Walker's recent decision to set a $20 million limit on the cost of any new legislation. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what does the governor had to say about why he's capping spending on new legislation at $20 million?
If you listen to what the governor said, it wasn't exactly a firm cap. I mean, he didn't send out a letter to the legislature and say, look, I see you're taking up a lot of bills. Some of these have a price tag. I want you to know we're not going to go above $20 million. It was just sort of at the tail end of a bunch of questions from reporters at after an event yesterday in Madison, a lot of them circulating around the budget. And the governor was asked, you know, is there a limit? And he said, you know, I think it needs to be in the range of $20 million. So it's not a firm cap, but he thinks that that would be a good number to hit.
Sounds like a suggestion, a firm suggestion at this point.
Yeah, it gives him some wiggle room, though. So if there are bills that they really like and that both chambers agree on, and, you know, he doesn't want to be in the position where he's vetoing bills by the Republican legislature. He just hasn't done that, and I don't think he's going to do that. You could imagine him exceeding that $20 million spending cap. But it was definitely unusual to hear the governor come out and say, we maybe need to watch what we're spending here.
So I've heard that there needs to be $65 million in the reserve fund. So what does that leave for new bills at this point?
I mean, if you consider all the money and you kind of take out this statutory reserve that they're supposed to put in there because they can get around that easily, they would end this two-year budget with an estimated $135 million. It's a two-year budget that, if you include all funds, is north of $70 billion. So that is not a lot of money. So then you start looking at these bills, and when you've only got a $135 million cushion, you have to look at every bill more critically. And so you've heard today the Joint Finance Committee met. They had a number of bills that had a price tag on them. And you heard Democrats saying, look, we actually agree with some of these bills. We're on some of these bills, meaning, you know, they're co-sponsors of some of these bills. But we have to look at everything in a new light now because we have the governor out there saying that, you know, we can only really spend $20 million more. And we have this new Fiscal Bureau memo out there saying that we don't have that much more money to spend, period, over the next couple of years. So I think you're going to hear that refrain quite a bit as we wrap up session here, that there's only so much money to go around.
Well, as you said, a bunch of bills scheduled for a vote in the Joint Finance Committee. How seriously are legislators taking that? As you said, it's a suggestion, a firm one, but how seriously is it being taken?
It sounded like some of the majority Republican lawmakers are saying $20 million sounds like a good number. But then you go through and you start adding them up and you realize that they could surpass that pretty quickly. There's a package of bills that the Assembly Speaker wants dealing with Alzheimer's funding. That adds up. You've got, you know, a package of bills that the governor wants for college affordability. Those aren't huge, but they add up. I mean, there's, you know, $5 to $6 million there. You've got this civil service bill that was just passed that both sides want. There's price tags on that, too. You can get to 20 pretty quick.
We're talking to Sean Johnson right now, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We're talking about Governor Walker's announcement today that he intends to cap any new legislative spending to $20 million this session. And Sean, what about Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald? What has he said about this, given all of the bills that are in motion right now?
Yeah, Senator Fitzgerald said something that actually came before the governor's comments on, you know, maybe we should hit about $20 million. This was at a meeting of the Wisconsin Counties Association. And they at the County Association, they have a representative from Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats, Assembly Republicans, Assembly Democrats, just kind of a casual roundtable. And they're asked to talk about what they see coming up the remainder of this session, what's going to come up next session. And Senator Fitzgerald volunteered next session, which is 2017, the budget. And he spoke about it in pretty dire terms. He said, I think next budget's going to be as tough as this budget. He said, you know, that the revenues aren't going to be there to keep up with spending. And his words, he says, that's what I lose sleep over because those are very difficult decisions. And, you know, so that puts another perspective on it, because this past budget was pretty tough by a lot of people's standards. You had a $250 million cut to the University of Wisconsin. In order to keep spending money on roads, they had to continue borrowing for roads and just a variety of other programs that had cuts in this budget, even at a time of economic growth.
Are there any bills that strike you at this point based on the reading of the political tea leaves that seem particularly vulnerable?
There are some bills that would cut taxes in a variety of ways. One in particular just passed committee this week. It's pretty technical, but the Department of Revenue said that it could be a fiscal estimate of maybe a couple $100 million. That's going to be tough to justify if indeed the governor wants to keep spending below that, and you just don't have that much money in the state's coffers. As far as the college affordability stuff, because the governor has put so much of an emphasis on that and basically made that his signature issue for the remainder of the session, it's only about $6 million total. I would expect that to pass. I think everything else, you kind of have to take it issue by issue.
Based on the quote that I read, the governor said that if money was going to be put toward public education down the road, there needed to be a good base. How does that factor in?
It's going to be hard to have that base. So, I mean, he's talking about, when he talks about the base, he's talking about this is how much money we go into the next budget with, basically. And he's talking about a variety of ways to increase funding on education, changing the way that the state insures its workers to a self-insurance system. But even if he does that and the state recognizes savings of, let's say, $40 million is what one report projected, that's just not big. I mean, I think there's not at this point a lot of money that's set aside for K-12 education unless some dramatic changes are made.
And Democrats, as expected, have been critical of this. They're saying that the state has turned down millions of dollars in federal money. What money are they talking about?
I mean, you kind of go back to the entire, Walker administration and some of his early, her early decisions in office were turning down federal money. You remember the high-speed rail. The notable decision that he continues to make now that is reversible is they're turning down federal Medicaid money. And, he said over and over he doesn't want to have an expansion of Medicaid in Wisconsin as part of Obamacare. But that is costing the state, hundreds of millions pretty much every year that they don't do it. So that's something that Democrats have continued to hit home, especially as other Republican governors do accept that money.
Sean, to the best of your knowledge, has there ever been a suggested cap like this on new legislation?
I suppose it could come up because it was kind of a casual number that was thrown out there. But it's definitely unusual to hear a governor talk in those terms, because now it'd be very easy for people to come back and say, well, hey, we did the math and these bills that you added up here, you're spending more than $20 million and you're not exactly leaving us on firm financial footing for the next budget. So that's why you don't hear governors, and specifically Governor Walker, make specific promises like that when it comes to spending, because in a way it ties their hands.
And do you think, as you said, this might leave a little bit of wiggle room? What do you make of the way that he's, kind of a toss-off at the end of a question instead of a big announcement?
Yeah, he you don't want to see, any governor doesn't want to put themselves in a box, basically. And so for him to come out and say, I will only allow $20 million, nothing more, this session, he's going to end up making enemies in his own party, because there might be a few bills in there that, on dementia, for example, and Alzheimer's funding, those are not extremely expensive bills, but they have a cost. But they're a priority of the Assembly Speaker. If he wants to continue to work with the Assembly Speaker on stuff, he might be expected to sign those bills once they get to his desk. And if he made that firm promise, it's going to be hard for him to do that.
Sean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, talking about Governor Walker's suggestion that he intends to cap new legislative spending to $20 million this session. A theater group in Milwaukee is taking on current issues of race and class by bringing us back to a racially charged moment in the 1990s with their production of Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992.
Through personal testimony of eyewitnesses and participants, the production takes us back to moments after the trial of the police officers involved in the beating of Rodney King. The officers were acquitted. Days of unrest followed that ruling. Joining us now to talk about the production from Next Act Theater, we have actors Marty Goebel and Andrew Perez. Welcome both of you to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, Marty, can you start us off by just talking us through the play, a very unique approach to telling the story?
Yeah, Anna Deavere Smith went and interviewed 300 people following the Rodney King race riots in 1992. And of those 300 interviews, she has taken 37 of them and put them in a play form. So the actors, myself and five others, we have divided those roles up, paying no attention to gender, race, age. Oftentimes we are playing toward type. But the play is the verbatim words of those interviews that were taken. So it's been a fascinating journey, kind of wading through a lot of aspects of these, the character development in the play itself, particularly the topic.
And Andrew, this is a different kind of challenge, I would think, for an actor. These are real people, their words, not the words come up with by a playwright, and you're playing a bunch of different roles. What goes into performing a piece like this?
Right. It is definitely a unique challenge and a unique opportunity to find new ways of approaching the text itself and also the people who we're portraying. So in some of the cases, the people who we're portraying are public figures or at least publicly known figures. Myself, I portray Maxine Waters at one point, the congresswoman from California. So clearly somebody who's in the public spotlight, Cornel West also in the public spotlight. But many of the characters are just individuals who were affected somehow by the riots and by the verdict. And so finding the context and the information that we can find, whether that's actual information or video footage of the people, or if that's just understanding as fully as possible the context from which they would be speaking, so that we can approach these characters as honestly and sincerely as possible.
And Marty, Andrew mentioned a couple of his roles. Can you give us examples of who you're playing?
Yes, I am playing Elaine Young, Beverly Hills real estate agent who actually started the fight to make silicone illegal. She's an interesting lady. Stanley Steinbaum, who is the former police commissioner for Los Angeles County. I play Elaine Brown, who was the first African-American to run the Black Panther Party, and including Twilight Bay, who was responsible for the gang truces in 1992. So just a wide array of people, middle-aged Caucasian men from Harlem and very rich Caucasian ladies from Beverly Hills all the way down to, Twilight Bay, who is a former gang member.
A lot of times when we read a book or see a play, it's kind of following one main character through their eyes or over their shoulder. Andrew, how does the story emerge from this really diverse variety of perspectives?
That's a great question. It's so much, to me at least, less necessarily about the story of the events themselves and a lot more about how it affected people on a very personal and very social level. So the question of, you know, what is the story that we're telling is kind of up to the listener and the viewer to determine for themselves what exactly the takeaway of this is, since the stories are so unique and so personal, how those stories affect each person and how they put their own lens onto what's being heard and said, I think is the thing that we're trying to do, is to get that active listening and get people to create an opinion for themselves and possibly go out and do something with that.
We're talking with Next Act Theater actors Marty Goebel and Andrew Perez about a performance they're doing in Milwaukee of the production Twilight Los Angeles 1992. Follows the period after the Rodney King trial verdicts. Rodney King beaten, caught on video, an early example of this, caught on video being beaten by police. Police ultimately acquitted. Unrest spread throughout the Los Angeles area. Nationwide attention there. Marty, a very, in some ways, unique story in American history. What does it mean in Milwaukee in 2016?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think it's important to realize that when you have a riot situation, often people take that as the beginning of something, when in fact it is an aftershock of a series of events. And so when you look at the Rodney King riots, that actually started back in the 60s and that Los Angeles was unable to recover. As I relate this to Milwaukee, I'm curious. We've had a lot of events, particularly in the area, that have led to a sort of social simmering, and there will be an end. There will be an aftershock. I think that the key to avoiding that is really getting to know the people in your community, no matter if they are from your particular everything or anything at all. And I think that's how it's relevant today and how it connects us to the past.
That's interesting. And Andrew, is that part of the intent, do you think, of doing this play now, that we look at a story like this and we try to hear it from so many different voices?
I think absolutely. I think that something we've talked a lot about is how political correctness has kind of almost sanitized the way that we communicate with each other. And this play kind of brings to the forefront what needs to still be communicated, and that these issues that were taking place in the 50s and 60s and 90s and are still present today have not really been dealt with necessarily, but simply kind of washed over with sanitized language. And so if we're able to start that conversation back up in a really honest way, then, you know, maybe we can avoid that aftershock and that explosion from resulting from this type of simmering.
Marty, when these events were happening, a lot of people presented the story in a way. There were villains, there were heroes maybe, but there were bad guys in this story. So for some people, it was the police involved, the court system, afterward, the rioters. Does this play judge?
No, I find it remarkably even-handed. You may or may not like a particular person and the conclusion they've come to, but there is an opportunity to glimpse how they got there, and thereby leading to a deeper understanding of certain opinions that, you know, you may or may not ever agree with, but you can at least understand how this person focused and moved towards that end of thought.
It's going to be interesting to see as an audience member, but I wonder, since to an extent you both tried to get inside the heads of the people you're playing, I want to ask each of you, Andrew, was there a character who you in some way empathized with, who maybe surprised you, you wouldn't have expected to?
In a way, all of them. I think the most challenging for me and ultimately I find the most personal pleasure and excitement in portraying Cornel West. He's such an intelligent and powerful speaker and orator, and to map through the monologue that I do at the beginning of Act Two was an incredible amount of work just to understand where he was coming from. And after doing all of that preliminary work and really digging into that, the message that he sends of a message of hope, not optimism, and the difference that lies between those, I think is one that kind of summarizes how I feel about a lot of this situation.
And Marty, how about you? Any character that affected you in a way that you might not have expected?
I love what Elaine Brown, the former head of the Black Panther Party, has to say. Of course, I agree with a lot of her theories, and in my research, it kind of shook me up how involved and organized the Black Panther Party was. And that is her large complaint to the young man that she's speaking to. Okay, fight. We're not saying don't fight, but think about what you were doing. Think long term. And I love speaking those words. She's incredibly eloquent and still keeps it just a little bit ghetto fabulous. So,
and Andrew, I don't think I've seen or heard about a play that's structured like this. Is this unique?
Yeah, I don't know of a lot of other work that uses this exact format. There are other plays that float around that are, for lack of a better word, kind of vignette-driven. But to use the actual verbatim words of actual people all surrounding one specific moment and the context of it, and then presented by a company of actors, kind of pointedly ignoring race, gender, and age, I don't know of any others that do what this play does.
Yeah, this is a different way of theatrical storytelling. This one is about this Rodney King verdict and its aftermath. Marty, Do you see maybe a room for kind of borrowing this idea, this approach? I mean, you could apply this to an event in Milwaukee or a scene in Milwaukee or just about anything, couldn't you?
Well, you know, it's fascinating that you would ask that. I serve as the education coordinator for Next Act, and we've taken on a really interesting project in which we're going into 6 schools, and we're having the kids mirror Anna DeVere's process. So they have been connected with pillars of the community from all ages, shapes, ethnic and cultural origins, and they will craft their own piece, dramatic interpretation of those words. I think it's important that our kids know the community that is feeding them and that hopefully they will feed. So this is, I think it's just a great thing. So we've stolen the idea.
That's great. Marty, I love that. What age group did you say?
We are dealing with high schoolers, 9th through 12th grades, 6 schools in the Milwaukee district. They have been connected with police officers, Congress people, actors, musicians, retired juvenile detentions officer. I mean, everything. A Syrian immigrant, lots of people. And it's just been fascinating having them define community and the components of community, what needs to exist under the current umbrella and what needs to go. It has been just an incredible ride. The kids, I think they don't get enough credit for how much they think about the world they live in. Mm-hmm.
Well, Marty, if I could say something, I should probably set up off air. Can we have you back sometime and maybe a couple of the kids involved in the project when it comes to its fruition?
Yes, you can. I'll bring my mini-me, in fact.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Marty and Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
It's been
a pleasure.
That was Marty Goble and Andrew Perez. They're actors in Milwaukee's Next Act Theater production of Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. The performance plays through February 21st. Tickets, more info at their website, nextact.org. And we're going to put a link on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The history of autism has been told in fractured pieces over the decades. With the new book, In a Different Key, the pieces come together to give a more complete picture of autism and how society has grown to understand the condition itself and the people who have it, from the story of case number one to the present day.
Karen Zucker joins us now. She's a producer and journalist for ABC News and the PBS NewsHour. She's the co-author with John Donvan of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So to start at the beginning, we have to go back before that first diagnosed case of autism in 1943. Tell us a little bit about the argument that autism isn't new, isn't a surge, that it's actually been around for centuries.
Well, we believe, and we can't say conclusively because you can never do that about history, that autism has been with us for centuries. And there are many stories that we reported on, people like the Holy Fools who walked around and had very similar characteristics. They were called the Holy Fools then, to people with autism. And we had one particular, Samuel Howell, Gridley Howell, did a legislative research through Massachusetts, and he studied all of the people who were called at the time idiots. And he saw in his work that there were caseloads of people who didn't fit the qualifications for what would define an idiot, so to speak, which is what people with developmental disabilities were called at the time. That wasn't an insult then. It was the definition. And you know, some of the cases he found had strikingly similar characteristics to people with autism. There was this one 56-year-old man named Billy who would repeat over and over again, time to milk the cows, time to milk the cows. We now know repeating over and over is a form of echolalia. He knew how to milk the cows, but he couldn't communicate it other than in repetitive ways. He also had perfect pitch, which is something we know is not unusual with people with autism. So there were many, many cases that that Samuel Howell found that would have today very likely been diagnosed as autism.
And in the modern day, to get to that first actual diagnosis using the word autism, we go to the story of a boy named Donald Triplett and his mother, Mary, and they were working, it sounds like, with a psychiatrist named Leo Kanner. What happened there? How did they get connected, all of those people?
Well, Mary Triplett and her husband, they knew there was something wrong with their son. And in fact, when he was 3 years old, they sent him, like many parents did, almost all parents of those generations, they sent him to an institution because parents were told to put your child away, forget you ever had them, and take care of the rest of your family. There was no place to send them to school, and that was what even someone like Dr. Spock advised in those days. And Mary Triplett, after having Donald at this place called the Prevatorium for almost a year, decided, you know, I can't give up that easily. And actually, it was Beeman Triplett who wrote Dr. Connor a 30-page letter describing all of the nuances of his son, Donald. And Dr. Connor, after observing Donald, it took almost four years for him to really figure out what it was. It was something he had never seen before, and until he got 11 cases, he did not diagnose anything. And that's when he came up with the term autism. And Donald T. was his very first case. And we're actually now friends with Donald, and we've been visiting down in Forest since 2007. And he's an extraordinary example of a success story.
Because, he's in his 80s now, right?
Yeah, he's 82 years old. And he has autism. He still has autism, but he lives an independent life. He learned how to drive his car. His mother taught him how to drive a car when he was 27 years old. He travels around the world. For many, many years, he worked at the family bank. But the key, we think, to Donald was that he grew up in a community that embraced him. And they embraced him because they didn't treat him as if he was different from anyone else. And they were very protective of him. And John and I, my co-author, John Donvan, and I like to think if we could bottle what they did in Mississippi, the world would be a much, much kinder place to everybody who's different.
It's interesting that he ended up such a success story, as you say, because after that relationship with Dr. Connor got established, he had a theory that could have been damaging to the mother-son relationship, at least. He said that the autism happened because of maternal coldness, and he wasn't the only one to end up saying that. How did he wind up on that for a cause?
Well, Dr. Connor, I think what happened is originally he saw that it was something innate, and I don't know if it was for greed or for popularity, but that wasn't taking off. And at some point, he sort of turned his tune and said, well, maybe, you know, it's because I'm meeting all these parents. They're all intellectuals. They're not connected to their children. You know, maybe it is because their mothers are cold, frozen, like in a refrigerator. And that was quoted in the Time magazine. And that took off like crazy. And in fact, Bruno Bettelheim, who called himself a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but was really only had his PhD in art history, took that theme, and really for decades and decades, mothers were told they were responsible for their child's autism. And the reason a child had autism was because their mother didn't love their child enough. And Bruno Bettelheim is really the person who hammered that home. And when you think about how insane that is, how these parents and especially these mothers who were doing everything humanly possible to try to help their child, and now they're being told it's your fault because you didn't love them enough. We tell this one story in the book where this mother whose son is finally diagnosed with autism, and she knew something was wrong with him, in order to get him into a program, and there were very few at the time because this is the 60s, she had to be open to psychoanalysis of her so that she could figure out what she did wrong to cause her child's autism. And this was a mother who was educated. And because she was educated, she had read the books by Bruno Bettelheim. So she thought, it has to be my fault. It must be my fault. And then one day in this psychologist's office, she says, oh, I know exactly what it is. You know, my son, when he first came home, he had jaundice, you know, he was yellow, and his hair stuck up, and he looked like a chicken. And I must have not loved him enough because I thought he looked like a chicken. This is what happened to these parents. It was tragic because it was tragedy on top of families doing everything humanly possible to try to help their children be part of the world.
We're talking with Karen Zucker right now. She's a producer and journalist for ABC News and the PBS NewsHour, and she's a co-author with John Donvan of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. And you were talking there about what mothers went through, and there was a mother who finally said, you know what, this isn't right, and I'm not going to take this. I'm going to try to change things. One of the first kind of autism activists, Ruth Sullivan. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Ruth not for a minute did she think it was her fault. You know, she had 9 other children, and she said, "It, you know, if it was my fault, why are the rest of my children fine?" And she set out to not only her fight wasn't about not being responsible, not worrying about if it was her fault or not. Her struggle with that was that she felt that psychologists and psychiatrists weren't doing anything to help the cause if they were blaming mothers and they were wasting all this time. So what she did is she decided she needed to organize and create a situation so that families who had children with autism could get together and try to change, literally change the world, and they did. They started the Autism Association of America and in 1964 with Dr. Bernard Rimland. And it was the first organization in the United States that fought for education for their children and helping to close down institutions. She really made a huge difference in the world for parents today.
How are things changing at that time? So this was in the 60s when Ruth was organizing and trying to effect change. But how were children with autism being treated in the schools? How were they seen in society then?
Well, children were, it was literally the law that you, if you had autism, you were prohibited from going to school if the school didn't want to take you. And so most children were in institutions. I mean, the reason you didn't see people grow, you know, decades ago we talk about, well, where were all the children then? Why didn't we see anybody with autism? It's because they were really in institutions. And, you know, this organization and parents fought to change the laws to get them, allow them into school, and once they were able to change the laws, there you didn't need the institutions in the same way also, because there was a place for children to learn. Society at the time thought people with autism and any kind of developmental disability were ineducable.
We're talking right now with Karen Zucker. She's a producer and journalist for ABC News, and we're talking about her new book with John Donvan. It's called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism.
And we want to know what you think. How do you think attitudes and acceptance of autism have changed over the years? What happened to help you better understand autism? And if you've been through maybe that roller coaster of different diagnoses, supposed causes over the years, what was your experience like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Karen Zucker. She's producer and journalist for ABC News and the PBS NewsHour, and she's co-author with John Donvan of a new book called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of the story of autism? Do you have this condition? Is it in your family? What is out there that helps you fit into the world? What else would help accommodate your needs or the needs of your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Karen, we're going to fast forward now. In your book, you take a close look at how the movie Rain Man actually brought autism into the public eye, the public consciousness. Here's a clip.
Of course, today's Monday. I always drive the car on Saturday. I never drive on Monday.
What is this? Who is this guy?
I don't know. She jumped into the car.
Yeah, we can jump out.
I'm an excellent driver.
Yeah, that's good. Come on. Why'd you let him get in this car?
He's not a toy. He says he drives this car.
Dad lets me drive slow on the driveway every Saturday. Of course, the seats were originally brown leather. Now they're pitiful red.
Dustin Hoffman there with Tom Cruise in the movie Rain Man. And that was a huge movie. It really kind of changed things for the way people saw autism if they had been seeing it until then. What is your take, Karen, on how that movie did?
Well, we think that what happened was people only thought of individuals with autism as people who, you know, would knock their heads against a wall and rock incessantly and be completely disconnected from the world. And what Rain Man did is it showed people that there was another dimension to people with autism, and that they were more related than someone who was completely disconnected from the world. But it also gave them a peek in, which I would say to somebody who had more classic autism, somebody who would need support for their entire lives. But the public hadn't seen anything like this before. Everything they'd seen before was, you know, were stories that had nothing to do with what autism really looked like. And Dustin Hoffman really took on this character. It was a breakthrough for people having a new understanding of autism. But at the same time, you know, the spectrum, the autism spectrum is so huge that the type of autism that Dustin Hoffman portrayed, you know, is only one type almost of autism.
So do you think people came away thinking, you know, this was what an autistic person looked like from that?
Right. Right. But in some ways, because there was nothing out there, at least there was a starting point for people to see and be able to talk about it, and the conversation got started about autism, a conversation that was really not out there at the time. There's two things that really made autism famous, we think. And one of them was Rain Man, and the other was the fear of vaccines.
Right, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. I want to take a caller first. We've got Jamie with us in West Bend. Jamie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, my son has autism, my going to be 8-year-old. And like I said I just want to say be an advocate for your child. I had to go through a lot of specialists who told me there's nothing wrong with your son. His dad and I had to stand up and fight for him. You have to be a voice. You're the only one that can, you know, do anything for your child. Your child doesn't have a voice of their own.
Jamie, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate that. And Karen, what do you say to that, the role of parents in advocating for their kids?
Well, I can tell you that we would not be where we are today if it wasn't for parental advocates and educators and researchers who put themselves out there to, you know, share and fight for things that autism families with autism need. I mean, you have to, you know, there are many children out there that don't have a voice. There are also people who have autism who are self-advocates and can speak for the struggles that they have. But for those who don't have a voice, the parents are key. And the thing that's very challenging about that is, you know, parents don't live forever and children become adults. And what we have not figured out in a very big way is what happens when children with autism become adults and their parents aren't there, and we don't have the support structure in place to help adults with autism.
Jamie, thanks a lot for the call. And Karen, let's get to that anti-vaccination movement. Now, that took off in the late 90s. There was a paper published by a British researcher named Andrew Wakefield. And tell us again what his theory initially, it's been debunked, but what was that theory and why did it have so much pull?
Well, he believed that the MMR, the triple vaccine, was causing autism, and his theory was totally debunked by the medical community. But what happened was, it wasn't crazy for a parent in the 90s to think, you know, my child seemed perfectly normal and they get this shot and now they have autism. But what we did in this country is we did study after study after study after study, and what we came up with was that vaccines don't cause autism. And so it was something that, you know, as a society, we need to move on from. But there are some parents that still just, you know, believe that. And you can't, if someone doesn't believe in science, it's very hard to change their opinion.
There are people who still ascribe to that theory today. Where is that movement? Is it moved off to the fringes of society?
It's not as large as it was, but it is what got people interested in autism, because now they were afraid. They were afraid that could this happen to my child? It is not as prominent, a theory for people, parents, as it was, because the research has been done, and we like to just sort of say, you know, we weren't sure. We researched it as a society. We know that it didn't cause it, and we need to move on.
Talking to Karen Zucker right now, producer and journalist for ABC News and PBS NewsHour. She's got a new book out with John Donovan looking at a comprehensive history of autism. It's called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. And today, we've got a cognitive diversity movement, neurodiversity, a broader understanding of what autism is. And you've got people out there like Temple Grandin. She has autism herself. She's front and center talking about the gifts that come with autism. How have efforts like that changed things?
Well, in some ways, the neurodiversity movement is, you know, teaching the world that being different is a good thing and being different should be accepted. there are, you know, just like any group of people, sometimes there are extremes on either end. And the extreme end of the neurodiversity movement really feels that, well, that you should not look to cure or treat autism, that this is the way the person is and you need to figure out how to deal with them. But they also believe, you know, in the greatest sense, that we need to embrace people who are different and to not try to change them and just try to accept who they are. The problem is that there are people who still are severely disabled. They still are banging their heads against the wall. They cannot, you know, feed themselves or do anything independently. And the neurodiversity movement, you know, doesn't think that we should be doing anything to cure that. And so that's the conflict when you look at the two extremes. But at the heart and soul of the neurodiversity movement, it's what we all want for anyone who's different, which is just embrace people for who they are, not who they aren't.
And as we wrap up, your book paints an evolution toward a world where we see autism as a difference rather than a disability. Are we getting there?
You know, we're taking tiny steps. I don't know how much time we have left, but at the end of the book, we tell this story about this guy on a bus who was pretty disabled. He had autism, and he was rocking, and he didn't have any language, and he was, you know, using his hands in front of his face, and he was starting to make some noise, and he was irritating the people sitting behind him. And this one guy just got sick of hearing the noises and said, hey, you know, why don't you shut up? Just shut up already. And this other passenger sitting across the way rised up and said, hey, he's got autism. What's your problem? Why don't you shut up and why don't you get off the bus? And the whole bus stood up behind this gentleman to support the young man who had autism. And so it shows us that there is a way to make a difference, and we're starting to, and people are starting to embrace people who are different without being told to.
That's a great place to leave it. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Karen Zucker. She's a producer and journalist for ABC News and the PBS NewsHour. She talked with us there about her new book with John Donovan called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. Which state has the fastest talking residents, and who can say a lot in just a few words? Well, a report from the company Marchex used data from customer service phone calls to rank the 50 states.
So who talks fastest? It's Oregon, number one. Our neighbors in Minnesota were second fastest. Obviously, Garrison Keillor was not included. The slowest talkers all in the South.
Now, we in Wisconsin are the 14th fastest talkers, but when it came to how much we actually talk in a given conversation, we're kind of the strong and silent type. We said the third least behind Oklahoma and Kansas. And the most talkative, that goes to the coast. It goes to New York and California and New Jersey.
So we talk pretty fast. All right, maybe not quite that fast, but then we shut up. We say our thing, and then we listen. So, I don't know, is this a good thing about Wisconsinites?
I don't know. It's interesting. I guess we just want to get in there quick and then get out and sit back and listen.
And I've had jobs where I worked with people from different states, and I found that the people I worked with in New York talk pretty fast and seem pretty aggressive, and it put me on edge. And then I worked with people in West Virginia, and I sensed them getting nervous, and I realized I was talking faster than their cultural style was used to. So
maybe
it really varies from place to place.
Maybe we just walk the middle of the road, find a nice sweet spot, and that's where we are, just like we are on the map, right in the middle. That's how we are in our speech.
More even-keeled conversation coming up here on Central Time.